From KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The critic David Denby has written a book that frets about the future of the movies. Not that this is an endangered medium, of course. There are plenty of movies making plenty of money, but Denby sees the difference between these massive digital spectacles with superheroes smashing up buildings and deeply personal films with strong stories and complex characters. Denby says the movies that most of us are seeing at the Megaplex are shaped by a business model, a model that has mucked up the culture and the aesthetics of the form and has actually changed the audience. The case he makes comes from the essays and reviews that he's written. Many of them are included in the book. David Denby is joining us today to talk about the future of movies and to explore these questions. What are we missing? What has been lost? And what still thrives? Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It takes about half a paragraph for the critic David Denby to lay out his new book on the future of movies. In the introduction, he prepares the reader that he's going to rend the air with terrible cries. He's going to indulge end-of-movies fears. He's going to herald Lazarus-like the signs of hope, rebirth, and generation. And David Denby says it's becoming tiring, watching hour after hour of these mega-digital blockbusters. It's not really the budget that bothers him. He loved Avatar, for example. But Denby is yearning for films made for adults, films with stories built around complex characters that have a kind of structure and a kind of meaning. David Denby says that movies most Americans encounter these days are shaped by a business model that doesn't, or can't anyway, risk making good movies. He says it's a corporate practice that's creating an audience it wants to sell to. The case he makes includes the reviews and essays he's written over the years as these trends were taking hold. And today in the program, he's joining us to ask the question, do movies have a future? That's the name of the book, Do Movies Have a Future? David Denby is, of course, movie critic for The New Yorker. He's also written for New York Magazine, The Atlantic, and others. Among his books, we talked to him about before. One of them is Snark, anyway, and David Denby's joining us from a studio in New York City. And David Denby, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Well, I guess we should you do this right up front in the book. You make it pretty clear that the book is in no way an expression of regret about your job. You still quite
oh
like
no God
your job.
No. Let's not argue ourselves out of a job here. That's,
yeah. Well, what was the thing that got you? I mean, I guess in some ways, I always saw Snark as a book that wasn't this expression of something you had to get off of your chest. Is it the same thing with this?
Well, I think it's been accumulating for more than 25 years, basically since the conglomerates took hold of the studios, tightened their control over production budgets and product.
Yeah.
And essentially turn movie making into marketing rather than let's find an interesting subject, make a good movie about it, and then figure out how to sell it. Instead, oh, here's this market out there that we know we can sell to. Let's fit our conception of the movie into that notion of what we can sell. And I mean, I'm personally sympathetic to the studio heads. I've met some of them. They're not, you know, evil people.
Yeah.
But they have to produce quarterly returns. Their bosses go in front of stock analysts and want to know what the revenue flow is going to be. So they make the safe choices almost again and again and again. And as you said in your intro, it's not the movies that I'm worried about.
Yeah.
I mean, in fact, there are some extraordinary movies out there right now. It's the six big studios which are owned by conglomerates which seem to me to be pursuing a very destructive business model which doesn't lay the groundwork for adult taste in movies. They're not creating an audience for grown-up movies, and that is the most destructive part. I mean, if you want me to go into detail about that, I'd be happy to. You mentioned it in your intro,
yeah.
And I think that's the most worrisome and significant part of this.
Well, we will. I want to get into that in depth because I think it's important. But let me ask you this first, though. I guess the book is for not just fellow critics, of course. It's for kindred spirits, it seems. The moviegoers, as you put it, who live in the same world you do.
Yeah, I think so. And I'm obviously adult moviegoers. I mean, I don't think kids are much interested in criticism. I mean, a few are. And a few even have a favorite critics that they follow. But a lot of them go to Rotten Tomatoes or Metacritic, the two websites that aggregate the reviews that are online, and just, you know, punch up with their favorite critics and or look at the score that they get. But it's mainly grown-ups who care about criticism and like to argue over dinner or over the water cooler at work. Yeah. It's very much a talking culture, movies. And of course, what dismays me is that that culture seems to have shifted to television.
Yeah.
And not because television isn't good. I think television is often, you know, better than movies at this point for the kind of work we're talking about. So, but I, you know, except for certain seasons and certain movies, it's a lot of it is just passes by, and it's an enormous, you know, publicity machine that sells these movies in the media week after week, and then they're gone within a week or two. They don't, you know, many of them, they don't seem to hang. They don't seem to have any catch the culture the way they used to be when, you know, as Pauline Kael, great critic, we used to call them the, yeah, our national theater. Yeah. Well, I think something like The Social Network has that kind of centrality. Lincoln has it. At Zero Dark Thirty, I think, will have it. There are some movies like that. The Hunger Games,
yeah,
not one that I particularly cared about, but still, it had that kind of conversation around it. Well, I don't know. Maybe this is maybe a New York thing. What I'm hearing people talking about constantly is television.
Yeah.
And that hurts.
Well,
we've lost. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say maybe we should talk about why that hurts, because you say, and you write about this in the book, that there is there's a difference. You say that there are still risks you cannot take on television, for example.
There's a certain kind of, I mean, it's hard to imagine Terrence Malick making The Tree of Life for television.
Yeah.
It's hard to imagine Bennett Miller having made Capote for television, although there are things that have come close to it. There's a certain kind of personal level of expression by directors and writers that's very hard to imagine working on television, or Paul Thomas Anderson's movies, mm-hmm, like There Will Be Blood or The Master. Those are not, you know, imaginable on television. So it's still the place for, yeah, you know, very strong director and director-writer combinations, which I'm very excited about at the moment because of the way that writers have played an important role in both the two masterpieces of the season, Lincoln and Zero Dark Thirty.
Mm-hmm.
Those kind of things are theatrical experiences still, and people, you know, great, talented people want to make them. So television is great for intimacy. Like Lena Dunham immediately realized after she made the small movie Tiny Furniture that it was television was the place for the meanings that she wanted,
yeah,
to get across.
Yeah,
she had a brilliant understanding with Judd Apatow producing behind her of, you know, how television worked.
This
for that
is Girls,
kind of, those kind
mention,
of meanings.
Yeah.
But yes, in Girls,
yeah,
which is now heading into another season.
Yeah,
and everyone is talking about that in the. In the way that they used to talk about movies.
Yeah.
So, yes, so there are subjects that are perfect for television, still big subjects that work best in movies. Zero Dark Thirty is a movie.
Yeah.
Boy, is it a movie. Lincoln is a movie. I mean, even though as by Steven Spielberg's standards, it's relatively unspectacular. It's rather somber, actually. And then there's, in fact, a lot of talk, a lot of interior scenes, but it has scale and a kind of climactic power that,
yeah,
I think works best in a big theater with a lot of people.
You say in the introduction of your book that you kind of don't get why more people aren't bothered by all of this. And you point out that there are those, and I have to say, I think I know them in my own life, people who are kind of rolling their eyes about all of this, fretting about the movies. And in fact, you say in the book, some of the smartest people that you know, and sort of particularly men, you say in their late 40s or a bit younger than that, find all of this kind of tiresome or melodramatic.
Because they've grown up with a conglomerate's controlling pop culture, and they didn't know that anything else was possible. They didn't go through the 60s and 70s in rock. They didn't go through the early 70s in movies when there was an explosion of talent in Hollywood, right down the center of Hollywood. I mean, we're talking about Coppola, Scorsese, Spielberg, De Palma, Hal Ashby, Robert Altman. I mean, they didn't go through that. That came just before they started becoming movies. So they have grown up with this conglomerate control of the media and this constant recycling of pop concepts and the same thrillers and the same horror movies year after year. That's just the environment that they seem – that seems like normal to them. They don't know the most important thing, which was that until about 1980, 1975, movies were made for grown-ups.
Yeah.
Essentially. I mean, of course, there were family movies. There were movies for kids. There was stuff on the Saturday serials. There was the whole Disney enterprise. There was a lot of cartoons, everything like that. But movies were basically made for grown-ups. And if you were growing up in the 50s, as I was, and you were 10 or 11, you were dragged by your parents to see films that you only half understood.
Right.
And that half understanding and half not understanding was part of laying the groundwork for not only grown-up taste in movies, but maybe even for adult life. You weren't expected to stay in a goofy state of euphoria looking at the same franchise movie over and over again until you were 35, which is what the studios are doing now. They have bought game companies. They have, you know, made deals with Marvel Comics and many of the other producers of pop culture to produce an endless stream of digital spectacles that they can catch kids with when they're 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 and hold them for 3 or 4 more movies. That's what Hollywood, the central part of Hollywood, is now about. It's a very narrow, very constricted idea of what movies can be. Mm. That's the cause of my despair. And as I say, a lot of people just take it for granted because they've grown up in it. They don't know that there was anything else that was different.
Yeah. You write this. You write, a successful marketplace has a vast bullying force to enforce acquiescence, even among journalists. So I wonder if are you taking...
You want an example?
Yes, please.
Les Miserables. It is terrible. It's a terrible movie. I mean, I never saw it on stage, and apparently the stage version is better. At least you're sitting 50 feet away from it. The movie version is right on top of you. The singers sing right into your face. The camera's about 8 inches or 10 inches away as if it were going to perform a tonsillectomy, which is no place to put a camera in front of Russell Crowe's mouth when it's open, especially since he can't sing. And neither can Hugh Jackman, by the way, who's at least a Broadway pro, but yeah. I think – his voice is awful. That, I mean, the accumulated box office of 60 million people having seen the show over a 25-year production stand has what was the phrase? A bullying force?
Yeah, bullying. You wrote it.
obviously a terrible movie. I mean, it's all melodrama. It's all elemental emotions. There's no humor. There's no ease. I mean, Anne Hathaway as Fantine has about 20 minutes of camera time in which she is tortured, abused, violated in a coffin box, her hair cut off, her teeth extracted, and then she dies. Yeah. I mean, it's almost pornographic in the punishment that's meted out to her, and people all over the place are in tears. I think it's accumulated pressure to respond to that kind of emotionalism to show that, in fact, you can feel. And now I'm going to get nasty, even snarky. George Bush's speechwriter, Michael Gerson, an administration that did not care at all about the poor in the United States, in fact, that encouraged Republican policies to squash the poor in any way, to, you know, remove the safety net and, if possible, roll back the New Deal, and is continuing, of course, in the Republican politics now. He wrote a piece about how this movie made him cry from beginning to end. Now, the movie is all about the downtrodden. My point is that it works on certain preset responses that are part of being a human being, that it doesn't create those tears honestly, and that there's a kind of dissociation. And so here you have a guy who actively worked against poor people crying over poor people on the screen. That's my point, is that the movie is totally manipulative and has nothing to do with the way we really respond to life. I mean, it's an atrocity. Now, it got a fair amount of bad reviews, but most of them have been positive. And I mean, I can't believe that those critics can't see what's wrong with it. I mean, it's just so obviously awful. Mm. So, all right, now I've made an enemy of half the world. I said this in a blog post at the New Yorker, and there've been over 200 comments, and most of them have been pretty unhappy.
Well, what are people saying about the book, or at least the concept that you're taking on this idea in the first place? Are you getting any pushback from that?
Oh, sure. I mean, people, as you say, roll their eyes and say the movies will always exist. And coming back to the first principles, there's plenty of interesting movie activity going on now. My attack is on the six studios and the conglomerates that control them. There are plenty of independent companies, including some other large independent companies that get their funding from banks or from overseas and so on, that are doing interesting work. There's all sorts of smaller companies in New York and Los Angeles and everywhere else that are doing interesting work. And there are kids who are going out and not just kids, but people in their 30s going out and making movies for $20,000, $30,000, $50,000. I mean, you can do it because of digital equipment. You don't have to print all of that film. It's very easy to light. The so-called micro-budget movies, which were briefly called mumblecore. Mm. I have a piece in the book about that. That's a term that the filmmakers dislike, so we've all agreed to stop using it. Let's call them micro-budget movies. So, I mean, I'm looking for a revolution from there. You know, something like Truffaut and Godard and Chabrol and those people who went out into the streets of Paris in 1959, 60, 61 and made movies for what was then seemed like a ridiculously small amount of money. It could happen here. They'd have to learn to trust writers more. I mean, the problem with it is they're all obsessed with the auteur theory and the notion of the director as the fount of creativity, and so they don't create scripts that hold you. Yeah. They hope that the inspiration will happen on the set, and sometimes it does, and most of the time it doesn't. But that's a possible place for revolution. I mean, and there, you know, something like Beasts of the Southern Wild, which was made for what was it, $1.3 million. Came out last summer. It's going to be nominated for an Oscar. It should be tomorrow. I mean, it's remarkable. Yeah. So it can be done. All it takes is talent and dedication. And that movie was made with amateur actors who just are more powerful than any trained actors could have been in those particular roles set in that particular place. Right. It can be done. I mean, and there's plenty of activity on all sides of the big guys. So it's not the movies that I'm worried about. It's mainstream Hollywood, which, you know, does dominate a lot of production and dominates most of the media attention. That's the problem.
Yeah. It's an interesting contrast that you lay out in the book. I mean, on one hand, you have Iron Man 2, which begins its run on like 4,300 theaters or something, 6,000 screens.
At least.
Gross receipts in the opening weekend approaching, you know, $330 million. Overall, it makes more than $620 million. That's the thing you have on one side, right? Which is, it's not a movie as much as it is a franchise. And then on the other hand, this contrast you write in the introduction anyway is – it wasn't a great film, but it was one that you used to sort of draw a comparison, and that is a film called Please Give, which cost $3 million to make. It did end up being a bit of a success. Talk about those two, the way you compared those two.
I talked to the director, Nicole Holofcener, and she said that her films make just enough money for her to keep going.
Yeah.
But it's very – she said each one is a struggle. It's very hard for those independently made, small, seriously crafted movies to get traction in the theaters because distribution is expensive. Getting the film properly opened in New York and Los Angeles and Toronto, which is the usual three-way opening of a movie like that, it is expensive if you're going to do it right. You have to have screenings. You have to have parties. You know, all of that can cost $250,000 right there. Then you've got to find the right theaters that will play the movies. The big chains, which work very closely with the studios, don't necessarily want your film.
Yeah.
Why? Because the money at the chains is made not through ticket sales per se, but at the concession stand. Yeah. The markup on Coke syrup and on chocolate bars is phenomenal, which is why the smallest candy bar is the size of an elephant patty and the smallest Coke is big enough to drown, you know, a rabbit or maybe a hedgehog in because they want you to buy those larger drinks. And that's also, by the way, why the time prior to the beginning of the movie, keeps getting filled with more and more coming attractions. Yeah. and and ads for local pizza parlors, right, and massage parlors and God knows what, because they want you to go back out there and get more to eat. That's where the money is made. So the ticket price just keeps the toilets clean and the projectors running. So they want those kind of films, even if they have to double, triple, quadruple them up at multiple screens within the mall center, rather than Please Give or something, or Beasts of the Southern Wild, if it's not going to bring in that many bodies to the concession stand.
Yeah.
And at the same time, those the other thing that's a menace to the individual theater is this conversion to digital projection, which costs anywhere between $65,000 and $130,000, depending on, I don't know, the size of the theater or the size. I'm not quite sure what the difference is, why one would cost, but it costs a lot of money, and a lot of these small theaters can't afford it. They're going to get squeezed out as more and more movies are released on a little hard drive that you just plug in, you know, to your computer rather than an old-fashioned film. And that worries me. So in other words, the bottom line here is that it's harder and harder for independent films to get traction even in the distribution marketplace. So what's the solution? Well, you could look at them online. I mean, you could, you know, rent them or buy them directly through the internet, or you could download them through one or another of the downloading services, whether it's Amazon or iTunes or Netflix or something. But then you're not having a theatrical experience.
Yeah.
You're looking at it on a computer screen or possibly throwing it across the room to a 46-inch screen. It's certainly better than nothing. But I'm a religious fanatic about that theatrical experience of going into the dark with 500 people who are complete strangers and having some sort of communal experience of everyone laughing and crying at the same time. I mean, in the sense of being part, at least for a moment, of a collective that's held. I mean, of course, it's, you know, you can be moved at home and excited at home looking at a little movie. I mean, a lot of us grew up looking at black and white movies on, you know, 11-inch and 13-inch television sets in 1956. But when you saw Citizen Kane with a fresh print in a revival house, it was overwhelming. When you saw it on a little screen at home, it was fascinating and strange, but the difference between the two experiences was enormous. So, in other words, downloading could be the solution to the distribution problem for small movies. It's hardly an ideal solution.
Yeah. David Denby is with us, movie critic for The New Yorker, the author of the book, Do Movies Have a Future? We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the future of movies with The New Yorker's film critic David Denby. Denby's worried about that future. When you have massive digital blockbusters that are sucking up most of the attention and the money, it's hard to make a movie that is smaller and more thoughtful these days. His book is called Do the Movies Have a Future? So one of the things you write about, David Denby, is this business model, this conglomerate corporate model. And you say this kind of outrageous thing that in some ways big movie studios can't risk making good movies. Doing so isn't a business. And I wanted you to talk about that. There's this term that you write about. They don't want films to be execution dependent.
Right. That's a standard business term. And it means pretty much what it sounds like, meaning that it might be successful, but only if it's extraordinarily well made. And that is a risk that since movies being extraordinarily good, you know, your chances are 1 out of 4 or 1 out of 5 or 1 out of 6 that they don't want to take. Mm. Whereas if you make another thriller, which has with a couple of male stars, which has a built-in audience, and you keep costs relatively low, that's a risk that they'll take over and over and over again. So directors who, you know, want to do something original like Paul Thomas Anderson or Bennett Miller or Alexander Payne. I mean, these are people who have made very good movies, can't get their funding through the major studios. So they spend 5, 6, 7 years, you know, beating the bushes looking for money. This current savior is an heiress, Meg Ellison, Larry Ellison's daughter, who put up the money for both The Master and Zero Dark Thirty. Those movies were not made by the studios. They would never have been made. Zero Dark Thirty is going to make a fortune, and it should have been made by one of the – this was after The Hurt Locker. The same team made The Hurt Locker. But another, but that kind of concept for a movie or a movie like The Master is execution dependent. It has to be extraordinarily good in studio terms to be sure of getting that opening weekend audience. The opening weekend is still extremely important, and this is one of the basic irrationalities of the movie business, because in fact, this is staggering. The total theatrical business in the United States and Canada is only 20% of the revenue that a movie brings in. Only that's it. 20%. The rest comes in from overseas and from licensing to television, to cable, and of course to DVDs. And so far as that's still a market, it's considerably down from what it was 6 or 7 years ago. Nevertheless, that opening weekend and all the éclat, all the noise, the boasting rights of being first, all of the entertainment stories, most of which are very misleading because they don't take into account how many theaters the movie is playing in and what kind of movie it is and so on. That opening weekend is still tremendously important in branding the movie for all of those ancillary markets that I just mentioned that come afterwards. So what does that mean in practice? It means that the films that you choose to make are skewed towards getting people who come out on opening weekend who are young people. So young people and particularly young boys, although girls are now getting into the mix more seriously because of success of
Twilight,
things like The Hunger Games. So you see where I'm going. That young people about 12 to 15 years to 25 years old are exercising an influence on what gets made way out of proportion in their numbers, not only in the population but in the movie-going population.
Right.
And that is what's screwing the whole thing up. I mean, there were ways out of this. Can I say that the ways out of this?
Yeah. Actually, I want to work toward that because I want to spend some time with that because you write about that and I want to spend some time with that. But one of the things you write about also is that this whole process makes films, because they're trying to get so much of the overseas money, is that they're making these films so broad that they can be appealing everywhere on the globe. You say aimed at Bangkok, Bangalore, as much as Bangor, Maine. So they have to be really broad.
I mean, these big movies are not made for us. If you go back to the 70s, we mentioned the golden era of the early 70s, there were a lot of movies that had very specific feeling about time and place. Very specific part of the United States that the movie was about. Nashville, right?
Yeah.
Or Chinatown, Roman Polanski's masterpiece, was Los Angeles in the late 30s. That isn't happening much anymore. The big digital spectacles are very generic. There's a generic big city that sort of looks like Chicago or New York, right? Or it's set in outer space, or it's set in a kind of nowheresville of exacerbated pixels fighting each other. And the reason, as you said, is they want to defoliate the movies of local flavor in any way that would limit the audience for them. So that means taking out wit. That means taking out, I guess you'd have to call psychology, any kind of in-depth notion of characterization. There is a kind of ironic playfulness in these big pop epics where they are sort of playing off each other. Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of jokiness, particularly when Robert Downey is in them. I mean, he's kind of a built-in walking irony. I mean, he's sort of winking at the audience all the time. There is that. But the kind of fun that movies were in the 40s and 50s and 60s can't go into these kind of big films simply because they're not for us. They're two-thirds of the box office on these films is coming from overseas. Mm. So they're as generic and as undetailed as possible. The movies that are about specific place and specific time, there's a small movie with a major actor in it, Matt Damon, called Promised Land, and it's about people who try to who go into small towns in Pennsylvania into farming towns and try to get people to sell their land, or rather lease their land, so the drilling can be done there to find the natural gas, fracking,
yeah.
Natural gas 2 miles beneath the cow pasture. That movie was made, I'm sure, because Matt Damon wanted to make it, and John Krasinski also. The two of them wrote the script together. So there's a case of actors taking the initiative to do something that's set in a specific time and place. But that's a rarity. So you see the problem.
Yeah.
There is a kind of impersonality to these big films that I find extremely depressing, and because they're not for us. There for everyone and anyone.
Let's take a call. Julie is with us in Salt Lake City. Julie, welcome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
David, I've loved listening to you, and my theory and my thoughts are just right with yours. And living in Salt Lake City, we have an amazingly unique opportunity with Sundance, and I'm a Sundance veteran. I've been going for years, and even though I'm in my early 40s, I just haven't grasped onto the megaplex and the pop culture, and am ever grateful for Sundance. Last year, you know, Beasts of the Southern Wild and meeting the cast and Please Give the year before and seeing Jennifer Lawrence on screen the first time with Winter's Bone, and amazing experiences. So my question is, how as a grassroots community, especially here in Salt Lake, do we try to get more interest in these movies and support our local film society and our indie theaters that are here in the Valley? I mean, it's a great opportunity for everyone, and I try to expose as many friends as I can and take them with me and let them see that it's not an exclusive thing. So anyway, that's my question for you. And I hated Les Miserables as well. Awful.
Oh, good. I've got one ally out there. Actually, there were a number of critics. I don't mean to pose here as some sort of lonely martyr.
No.
There were a fair number of critics who said this isn't any good. Well, tell me, what happens to the films that you mentioned, and you could have mentioned 30 others,
after
Sundance? I mean, in Salt Lake, do they show it locally in Salt Lake? Is there an art house or two or three?
They do. We do have one art house that has, I think it has 5 or 6 screens, which is great. And they do try to advertise as much as they can with their budget. You can become a member of the Salt Lake Film Society. But it kind of has this aura of an uppity, intellectual-only feel, you know? And so trying to reach the common man, I guess, and say, no, these are great. It was actually really inspiring to go to the opening night of Moonrise Kingdom and see a line out the door, because that's pretty rare to see that many people.
That did very well.
I think
Wes Anderson is someone who does manage to work within the system, because he keeps his budgets low and he prepares each movie very carefully, and he gets wonderful actors like Bill Murray to work with him and so on. That's a real success. I don't know what the answer is. I wish criticism were as powerful as it was in the 70s in influencing taste. I think advertising for large movies simply overwhelms the smaller ones, which don't have advertising and promotion budgets to make people aware. And then there's a way in which ordinary moviegoers don't want to be associated with losers somehow. They don't want to be associated with small movies. Because it's somehow that's loserdom, or it's a kind of anti-elitist snobbery in a way, bizarrely kind of reverse thing, where you want to go to the popular thing that's being advertised on every radio station and every television, so at least you can be part of that conversation, and that's what we're fighting here, as much as me. I mean, and it's a juggernaut. It's power and money that just rolls over everything else there. I mean, when these big things open, they may be gone in 3 weeks, but sometimes you feel like there's nothing else happening because it comes at you from every angle, including, the product tie-ins with McDonald's and Burger King and shirts and beer mugs and condoms and God knows what else are sold this way.
Yeah. Well, David, here's how
it's universal marketing.
Yeah. Well, here's how you put it in the book. You say that, will this created audience, will it ever develop a taste for narrative or character or irony and wit or great acting? And, without the digital effects or without the fantasy. And you say, I ask the question, but I don't have an answer. There's not an
answer. You mean, kids.
Yeah.
Will kids, I think what will likely happen is that as they get older and as they marry and have children, they'll simply give up on movies, as many have, and watch television. And who can blame them? I mean, there's good stuff. There's a lot of ordinary stuff too, I'm sure, and routine, you know, kind of series making. But there's also not just on cable television, but even on network television, occasionally stuff that's very absorbing. So I think that's the answer is that, because they feel that the movies are no longer for them, except for this amazing period every fall, which starts around October 1st and ends Christmas Day, when by some miracle the audience IQ goes up by 40 points on October 1st, and all the serious films come out. And let me just say, that Lincoln is absolutely marvelous, I think, and Zero Dark Thirty is absolutely marvelous. These are two great films. The Life of Pi has about an hour in the middle, which does depend on digital. You can't teach a tiger to act. It's an entirely created tiger on the boat with a wonderful young Indian actor. And there's about an hour in the middle of that that's quite enchanting. So the fall season often is very striking. But why not distribute those good movies throughout the year? Why cast out grown-ups as if they were downsized workers to wander disconsolately in the nowheresville of thrillers and digital spectacles for the other 8 or 9 months of the year? I mean, it's senseless. Yeah. So a lot of people just sort of give up until they wake up again in that fall season. A lot of grown-up audiences.
Yeah. Julie, thanks very much. Back to the phones. Mark is with us in Salt Lake. Mark, welcome.
Hi there. Thanks.
Sure.
As I've listened to you talk, I realize that, yes, things have changed, but if Andrei Tarkovsky can make any of his films in Russia, then surely, given all the strikes against him, surely we can do something, somehow here. I mention him because he's one of my favorite filmmakers, and I've been reading Jeff Dyer's Zona lately, and his critique of filmmaking and everything else, and just curious to know, to get your response to his take on films, and in particularly Andrei Tarkovsky, as well as your response to, if he can make films, surely we can make them too, somehow, like Beasts of the Southern Wild, somehow they'll get made.
Yeah, it's being done elsewhere, yeah.
Yeah, well, maybe you can answer this better than me. How much was that a one-time miracle in Russia? Tarkovsky, and how I don't know how he raised the money for those films. I have the feeling a lot of it came from Europe, not from Russia. I mean, he was recognized as a genius and was able to survive. I thought the Wachowski brothers might become something fantastic, but they haven't. they've become something very, I think, banal and commercial. There's no reason why that kind of talent can't exist here. You're absolutely right. I mean, and there is enough independent financing outside of the studios for visionary directors. Maybe Darren Aronofsky will become someone like Tarkovsky. I mean, he certainly has the talent. I wasn't crazy about Black Swan, but he certainly can do amazing things with imagery. So the answer is there's no reason whatsoever why this couldn't happen here. Let's just hope it happens. I mean, I hope that kind of talent can find the money. They're not going to find it from studios. They're going to find it from overseas, or from a few renegade producers, or from heiresses and wealth, other people from wealthy families, like I've mentioned Meg Ellison a couple of times, who's the current savior. I mean, she probably lost her shirt on The Master, which cost a lot of money, but she'll make it back on Zero Dark Thirty. So the answer is it could happen.
Yeah. Mark Legicol, thanks very much. David Denby is with us. His new book is called Do the Movies Have a Future? And we need to take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with the New Yorker film critic David Denby. His book is called Do the Movies Have a Future? I've got a comment on Facebook from Ryan, who says the beauty of going to the movies is that you get to check out and escape for 2 hours. Younger people, he writes, don't seem to want to check out anymore, but rather, thanks to smartphones, they always want to be connected, seemingly unaware of the dangers of overfeeding their ego. Cinematic storytellers, he writes, now have to fight to keep these fractured attention spans focused. I wonder, do you agree with that?
I think that's a very profound remark, and I don't think that I'm sure that the studio people are very worried about this. That I mean, I spent a lot of time last year with 15-year-olds in a 10th grade English class for a book project, and I got the feeling—not more than the feeling—I definitely got the information that when they came home, most of them turned on Facebook at 4 o'clock when they got home, and turned it off at 11 o'clock or 12, whenever it was that they went to bed. And no matter what else was on their computer screens, Facebook was on one part of the computer screen, and that narrative of the self, of what they had done that day and what their friends had done that day, in which you're the celebrity, you're the star, which everyone wants to be in this culture, is more powerful possibly than any created narrative, just as the gentleman suggested. And that scares, believe me, that scares the studios a great deal.
Yeah.
That anxiety that you might be missing something, which is why people, you know, if you go to any public place, you see half the people, including people in company, sitting looking at their cell phones, right? It's a terror that something is happening somewhere that might affect you and you don't know about it.
Yeah.
And it's totally irrational, 95 times out of 100. And yet, you know, it's an itch that you have to scratch. Can I just interpose here one thing?
Sure.
I've been lamenting a great deal, but the book itself, by the way, is only one part of it is about what's wrong with the business model and so on. A lot of it is celebratory writing of movies that I love and directors that I love and, I mean, like the Coen brothers or Almodovar or Otto Preminger in the past, or my complaining about Quentin Tarantino. And there are genre pieces about chick flicks and teen films and so on. It's not – I don't want our listeners to think that it's all this lamentation of where the big studios are taking us.
No, and I have to say I want to ask you about a couple of these sections. One I really loved was the section about movie stars and the piece you wrote about Joan Crawford, which was terrific.
Well, I've always been fascinated by her. I may be one of the few straight male critics who would write 10,000 words on Joan Crawford, but why not?
Yeah.
I mean, because she this fascinating person because she came out of nowhere and through sheer determination and drive and a good deal of work on her body and her face and you know, collaboration from generations of photographers and so on, made herself into this amazing avatar of glamour. And did she have any talent as an actress? She had a limited talent, which really when she was very young, she was a kind of good time girl, a kind of flapper, and she jumped around wildly and she was sort of fun and exuberant and but then she became sort of heavy and gloomy in the 1930s. But when she finally landed in the right place at Warner Brothers and started working with people like the director Michael Curtiz in Mildred Pierce, which was her breakthrough and got her an Oscar. And at last she found those kind of noirish, depressive, angry, violent plots that suited her own amazing combination of pride and self-disgust.
Yeah.
So she's enduringly fascinating in a way that doesn't have to do with her talent so much as with the kind of projection that she made not only on the screen but into people's lives. I mean, she had an enormous fan base, mainly women. Men never much liked her. They found her a little overbearing and a little hard to take. They didn't like her the way even they liked Katharine Hepburn or Betty Davis, who was, God knows, hard-driving also. Women particularly saw their lives through her, and we don't have that anymore. We don't have actresses who can make movie after movie. I thought Julia Roberts might become that for a while, but as she got older, she ran, you know, and she ran out of vehicles that suited her temperament, and that she's in a kind of crisis mode now that she's in her middle 40s.
Yeah.
The one, of course, who came through this brilliantly was Meryl Streep.
Yeah.
But she's a different kind of actress. She's not someone who settles into a persona. She's a chameleon who can do anything.
Yeah.
You know, she settles into everyone else's persona and just recreates herself through that, whether it's Maggie Thatcher or whether it's the editor of a women's magazine or anything else. That's at a level of talent of acting that Joan Crawford couldn't possibly reach. I think what's happened to stars, the smart ones, like we've mentioned Matt Damon and increasingly Brad Pitt, who I didn't respect at first, but I think has become a hell of an actor as he's past 40. And the smart ones are double-tracking their careers. They're appearing in big commercial things like the Bourne franchise for Matt Damon. We'll see if he gets back into it after Jeremy Renner took a shot.
Yeah.
And smaller films like Promised Land, I just mentioned. But Matt Damon, you know, is a very smart guy who will do anything if he trusts the director and the script. They know the prison. They want to escape. George Clooney being, maybe the most prominent example. And they're wonderful actresses. There's a young crop. It's not as if there's an absence of talent there. I mean, obviously Jessica Chastain is a kind of miracle. Emma Stone is, I think, terrific. There's plenty of talent there. But they don't get the scripts handed to them that, you know, by the main studios that they really can shine in. And so they wander off into smaller films or into television.
Yeah. We should mention that you also spend some time with because you spend some time talking about criticism and what's the role of criticism. You write about how it is that you, as a critic, if the language of film has changed, How do you write about it? How do you review it if that particular thing is changing? It's an interesting section, too. You talk about James Agee and Pauline Kael, two particular critics who defined the movies that they loved in their eras. Do you see yourself in a place like that?
Well, not at that level of talent, alas. But I think – well, critics do a number of things. Obviously, as you can tell from my whole discourse here, we keep score.
Yeah.
For the audience, we are sort of preaching at people saying, go to this, don't go to that. We're hoping to influence the direction of the medium by bringing box office to movies that we think are good and discouraging box office of movies that we think are bad. We don't have much effect in that way. Nothing that I say or that anyone else says about Les Mis is going to stop it from grossing hundreds of millions of dollars. That's for sure. But we can help little movies. And you mentioned Beasts of the Southern Wild. Tony Scott, A.O. Scott's review in the New York Times made that movie.
Yeah.
And then a lot of others also, Roger Ebert, myself, many other critics. But that movie could have slipped into the oblivion that awaits so many talented independent films without critics. So pointing toward new talent, as Pauline Kael pointed toward Martin Scorsese in the early 70s, that kind of thing is still absolutely centrally important, as well as keeping score. Being alert about independent filmmaking and low budget and micro budget stuff we've been talking about.
Yeah.
If there's something does break through there, that would be an important critical role. And what we need, since print critics are being fired all over the place, since editors don't think that we matter very much, what we need is some kind of new film magazine online that is not scholastic and stuffily written like traditional film magazines, but that's combative and fun to read and erudite and funny all at once, so that if a lot of films do start pouring through the internet rather than going through the distribution process in theaters, you've got a place to go to read about them. And there is something in pop music, there is Pitchfork.
Pitchfork, yeah, I was going to mention. Ongoing debate, you know, where you can talk about the music you like, and you can be snarky, and you can be funny, and you can be witty, all
of
those things.
We don't have that. We have these aggregation sites, like we've mentioned Metacritic and Rotten Tomatoes, and we have about 1,000, websites of and blogs of all kinds. It's a kind of horizontal Tower of Babel. I mean, everyone has an opinion, but nobody's opinion really matters. And that's you still need A.O. Scott at the Times and Kenny Turan in the Los Angeles Times and Mike Phillips in Chicago and, you know, and Anthony Lane and me at the New Yorker and so on, and people, David Edelstein at New York Magazine. You still need some people that have some a portfolio behind them and some authority. I think we're still necessary, even if editors don't agree with me. And then, of course, then there's the particular compositional problem, which I think you were alluding to in your question, which is how do you review?
Yeah.
How do you review Iron Man 7? You know, what is there fresh? You don't want to make the same kind of stale jokes. You don't want to be ironic about what you're doing and sort of ironize yourself out of any kind of reasonable critical function. You want to be serious but not stiff. I mean, it's difficult.
David Denby, movie critic, of course, for The New Yorker, author of the book Do the Movies Have a Future? He joined us from New York. David, thanks again.
Thank you very much. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks. Radio West, a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Susan Anderson, to Taylor Almond as well. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.